so there could be no enemy exploitation. Flying into the high mountains of Afghanistan, especially with winter approaching, was no easy matter. That night, after navigating a couple of armed roadblocks, common in Dushanbe, we were back at the airport. We watched the two CH-47 helicopters land. Once the choppers were on the ground, their rotors still turning, Burnson and his men loaded all weapons, ammo, spare parts, and other gear. I thanked Ron for the support. He would remain in Dushanbe, serving as one of our lifelines. Ron would later rise through the ranks of the clandestine service to become a division chief. I watched all the movement around the whirling birds and followed the crew's instructions. I also mirrored the movements of Admiral Calland as he walked to the chopper and loaded up. He had flown on CH-47s and other helicopters countless times. For me, this was a new adventure. This was my first flight on a CH-47. Any helicopter, in fact. Ever. I made it on board without bodily harm or embarrassment. With my 9mm Glock pistol on my belt and my survival gear in a small backpack, I wedged myself into a seat and strapped down tight. I double-checked everything. The immediate tactical imperative trumped any thoughts of strategic planning. This mission would require a dynamic mix of both, with the discipline to know when and how to focus on what. I looked over at Bert sitting next to me. He looked like the Michelin tire man, all wrapped in bulging layers of clothes. I had given him grief for his ridiculous-looking attire. In response, he had just smiled. The side and tail doors were open for the gunners to have clear views and fields of fire. The wind whipped through the fuselage as we lifted and turned south. We hurtled toward Afghanistan, only a couple hundred feet off the ground. About 30 minutes later, we slipped across the border. I breathed deeply, acutely conscious of our responsibility. I thought about the horrible attacks on 9/11. I thought about the USS Cole and our embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi. What a privilege to lead such men into the heartland of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. I had never been more grateful to my country and my leadership for the opportunity to serve. Nor had I ever been more confident and more intent on a mission. We started to climb as we approached the northern flank of the Hindu Kush mountain range. Soon, I had never been so cold. We had overloaded our chopper, now straining to clear the towering mountain pass. Bolts were popping off the airframe. At 16,000 feet, the pilots started circling and dropping fuel to lessen our weight. I looked out the tiny window and saw the other CH-47 carrying Burnson and others. Bert took off his headset and rolled his eyes. He didn't want to hear any more descriptions of the airframe's problems. Well, at least he's warm, I thought. I had layers, but not enough. It was 10 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. With the wind hurtling through the open doors, the wind chill made it even colder. I curled up on the seat, to the extent possible, bringing my knees to my chest to preserve my core temperature. We kept circling and dumping fuel. I thought to myself, this is just great. Ache hurtling through the open doors, the wind chill made it even colder. I curled up on the seat, to the extent possible, bringing my knees to my chest to preserve my core temperature. We kept circling and dumping fuel. I thought to myself, this is just great. AQ won't get the chance to kill me because I will freeze to death. Kofor will not be happy. Eventually we pulled up, higher and higher, and then over. We started a steep descent. I looked out the window and the sheer mountain walls were only feet away. The pilots skillfully maneuvered down and through the steep canyons into the Panjshir Valley. At about 0300 hours, we landed in a rocky, dry riverbed. Armed Afghans greeted us. So did one woman who rushed toward me with her hand outstretched, apparently wanting a handout. One of the Afghan men yanked her back and dragged her away by the hair. The rotors kept turning. We started unloading. Schroen and part of his team arrived. I shook their hands in the dark and the noise as they loaded into the chopper. The Special Forces soldier, strapped onto a stretcher, was among them. He would survive. The CH-47s were on the ground for just a few minutes. They lifted off for the return ride to Dushanbe as we scrambled for the trucks. We proceeded up a dirt track to the safe house, an old stone structure on the side of the steep valley. We greeted our Afghan hosts and our men. I double-checked with Burnson about the security, and we radioed HQS in Dushanbe about our arrival. I found a pad and blanket on the floor and racked out. 4 hours later, we were up. I walked outside into the morning light, breathed the cold, fresh air, and gazed down the narrow Panjshir Valley. Small homes dotted the valley on both sides of the clear, frigid river that flowed from the Hindu Kush to the Somali plains. I was in Afghanistan, finally. Burnson was already at work. He was counting the millions in cash, buying vehicles, dispatching recon teams, arranging meetings with senior Afghan allies, forging deeper links with the Triple Nickel, and plotting how to rescue 8 Shelter Now International, SNI, missionaries, including 2 American women who were being held by the Taliban. RF's Kabul intelligence cell had penetrated the Taliban guard force protecting the hostages, and we were getting daily reports and seeking to bribe their way out before the assault on Kabul began. I spent the morning with our team and our Afghan allies, reviewing the intelligence and the military plans. We met with U.S. Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel Michael Haas. Later, we gathered on the side of a hill and took a group photo. Burnson continued haggling with RF and others about money, intelligence priorities, and the SNI hostages. Late that afternoon, Bert, Hamid, others, and I drove south, down the valley to Bismillah Khan's fortified observation and command post. Khan had command of the Allied Afghan militia responsible for the assault on Kabul. His command post was perched on the windswept ridge above the northwest corner of the Somali plains. Large stone walls surrounded an ancient stone edifice high on a mountain overlooking the ends of the earth. The sun was setting behind swirling clouds. A large black bird of prey circled at eye level, lazily scanning for its next meal on the hillsides below. Armed warriors in varied dress with a variety of weapons sauntered around the mini fort. Except for the firearms, the scene could have been set in a Conan the Barbarian novel. Khan greeted us as we entered the large room. It was surprisingly warm. The thick walls blocked the wind and held the sun's heat. Heavy, hand-cut beams secured the roof above us. The day turned to night as we took our seats. Khan, with deep-set eyes and prominent, ridged nose, sat at the head of the table and began the discussion. Our Afghan allies, perhaps a dozen, asked us many questions about our intelligence and military capabilities. I inquired about their vision for Afghanistan. They recounted the Soviet occupation, the Civil War, and how Afghanistan needed leadership. I inquired who would be the best to serve as president. They all agreed that it must be a Pashtun. Otherwise, there would be no way to bring the South into the government, no way to forge a nation-state. The fact that these were mostly Tajik commanders advocating for a Pashtun president gave their view great weight to me. I had earlier asked the same question of Abdullah Abdullah, who is half Tajik and half Pashtun. He had responded even more specifically. Karzai was the only choice, because he was Pashtun and he embraced the concept of national identity. Abdullah Abdullah would eventually become the foreign minister under Karzai and resign in protest then run against him as a presidential candidate, only to lose in the rigged 2009 election. After an hour or so, they got to the heart of the matter. Although politely expressed, the question was blunt. Could they depend on the United States to keep its word? They explained how they had fought the Soviets, convinced that the United States and the international community would help them rebuild their country and establish a national government of unity. That did not happen, despite the promises. The United States had lied. What, they demanded, would be different this time? I talked about the horror of 9/11, how Christians, Jews, and Muslims all died at the hands of Al-Qaeda. I explained our blood-bound duty to avenge them and to make sure AQ never has a safe haven in Afghanistan again. I said that it was in the United States' vital interests to have a stable Afghanistan where our enemies could never again establish themselves to attack our homeland.